Amazing how you can create suspense just by bringing the chairs out. And I hear everyone getting hushed. And I'm quite tempted to sit at the table, but we'll sit here. And I'm going to invite my very good friend, I call him Richard, but he's Professor Bugs in his official sort of scientific title. And I'm glad that you've got a suitably professorial looking outfit as well, Richard.
Did my best, yeah.
This interview is totally unplanned, unscripted, just because we've known each other a very long time, and I've heard Richard speak on this subject before, so I know he's kind of happy for any question, and we'll see how it goes. And then we decide afterwards whether we make this known on the internet or whether it's just between us, so depending on how extraordinary the questions are. But Richard, just to start with, just to get to know you as a person, you've got a couple of quite interesting hats, but one of your interesting hats is you live on a farm near your parents with your own family. So tell us about how you fit into the generations of Bugses.
Sure. Well, yeah, thanks. Good to be here. And I live in Kent. I was born and brought up near Tunbridge, down in Kent. And a couple of years ago, my wife and I found ourselves in a two-bedroom flat in southwest London with a third baby just arriving. And at that point, we decided we'd better move back out to the countryside. And I think our neighbours directly above and below us in the flat were quite relieved when we made that decision. So now I commute into London for work. I work one day a week at Queen Mary University of London in Mile End, and 4 days a week for Kew Gardens in southwest London, where I do research.
And you live in a round house, at least part of your house is round.
Yeah, so we live in an oast house. So you know when you go to Kent, there's all these old buildings that were used for drying hops, and they have these round sections with a conical roof with a kind of white thing on top. We live in one of them.
And your bedroom is actually in the round bit, isn't it?
Is that right? That's correct, yeah.
It's very cool.
Yeah. It's very disorientating at night. if you need to get up in the dark, it's actually very easy to sort of miscalculate where the door is in a round room. I've discovered.
You got four children.
Yeah.
And the youngest is born this year. So
he's 6 months, yeah, just over 6 months now.
Yeah. So thanks to them for you coming and spending your day with us. And it's quite a sacrifice to be away from family at weekends.
Well, my mother-in-law has very kindly come all the way down from Preston to help so that I can be here. So thank my mother-in-law.
Please pass on our thanks to her. Now, the reason people have, I guess some people have come in especially to be here, but you have some regulars from Candlewater, some people from the other services, some people here for the first time as guests, particularly because they're interested in your angle as a science professor who is a Christian. And some people are thinking, like, how can that possibly be? Like, I mean, surely it's like a schizophrenic thing. Like, on the one hand, you're a scientist who's into facts, and on the other hand, you're a Christian who's into fairy stories. Like, how can you possibly square, that's not what I think, by the way, but that's what a cynic might think. How can you square your belief in Bible stuff with your scientific methodology that you use during the week?
Well, I'd say, first of all, Christianity has many facts, and modern science also has some fairy stories. So the two are not as different as you might think. You know, it's not fact versus fairy stories. It's quite the opposite. And basically, I see Christian faith as a response to evidence. Hmm. I think there's really strong evidence that Jesus is the Son of God, that he came into this world, he lived, he died, he rose again. And so my faith in him is a response to that evidence. So as a scientist, I see no conflict between weighing up the evidence for Jesus and believing in him, and then weighing up the evidence for something in the way I might do at work and believing that. And actually in science, a lot of what I believe in science is due to eyewitness testimony. You know, I don't go into the lab and test out everything that I believe as a scientist myself. In fact, hardly anything that I believe as a scientist have I personally figured out in the lab directly from the evidence. I'm spending all my time reading about what other people tell me they have done in the lab and what their evidence is suggesting, you know, and I'm constantly reviewing papers for journals and trying to work out, did they do what they say they did? Was that a reasonable thing to do? And does it prove what they say it proves? And so when I come to the Gospels, I'm kind of doing the same thing. You know, the writers of the Gospels are telling me they saw these things. This is what it means.
Just for people who don't know, the Gospels are the four eyewitness biographies of Jesus. So one of them's on your seats, the sort of pinky coloured thing, which you're welcome to take away. But four first century accounts of Jesus. And you're saying you approach these in a way not too different to how you approach the scientific paper.
Yeah, in fact, I'd say it's exactly the same. You know, I'm saying, is it reasonable what they're saying? Does it prove what they're saying it proves? And so I'm weighing it up in very much the same way as I'm weighing up a scientific paper that I'm reviewing for a journal.
There's also, I mean, obviously science is a big field and there's lots of different branches of science. And we could talk about astrophysics and the Big Bang. And we had an excellent introduction to that with our table. How did the table get there? I love that illustration from Johnny. Actually, the Big Bang is quite good news for Christians and quite bad news for atheists, right? Because Christians have always believed that the universe had a beginning and that God is the one who made the Big Bang go bang, whereas atheists really have a headache just describing why is the universe here at all. So we could talk about that, and you can ask Richard about that later, but his real expertise is not in physics but in biology, and particularly in evolutionary biology. So your title is Professor of Evolutionary Genomics, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Rich is one of the foremost experts on this that we could have got today, and he's a Christian. Now, that's interesting, because a lot of people think that surely it's Darwin's theory of evolution that's meant that we don't need to believe in God anymore. Because in the past, people think that we were designed and made by a creator, and now we understand, oh, it's just evolution, that's what made us instead. Now, you are really an expert on this very thing. What would you say back to the sort of cynic, the atheist, who says Darwinism explains away the need for a creator?
I would say I very much don't think he did. I think the first thing I'd want to say is just to back up a little bit and say the word evolution is the word that gets used in very different ways. So if I said to one of my colleagues in genetics, what is evolution? They would say changes in the frequency of alleles in a population over time. So they'd say what it is it's changes in how common a certain variant of a gene is in a population. So if, for example, the population of London over 10 years increases its number of people with ginger hair by 1%, that's evolution, because it's a change in gene frequencies in a population. That may have just been, you know, driven by immigration of people from Scotland to London, but it's still evolution, you know, because it's a change in gene frequencies. So that's evolution. But then sometimes when you say the word evolution, people, and quite often, particularly in the public, you immediately think of a story about everything in life today having come about through an undirected, purely natural process, you know, starting in a warm puddle or something like that. And then with no purpose, no foresight, no God, no nothing, just natural forces that evolving into all of the complexity and diversity that we see around us. And obviously those are two very different claims. You know, you'd have to be crazy to think that gene frequencies don't change in a population. But to think that everything came about by an undirected natural process is a huge leap of faith. And you have to ask, where is the evidence for that?
It's interesting you use that phrase, right? Because often that's the phrase that the atheist uses against the Christian. They say, oh, you make a leap of blind faith. But you're using that phrase against them. You're saying, no, actually, to take what we know about evolution and then to say it can explain the whole thing from a warm puddle, as you put it, to a human being, that is a leap of faith.
A massive leap of faith, yeah. And one that I don't think there's a huge amount of evidence supporting. Because to start with, you have to have the origin of life. You know, you can't have any evolution happening until you've got life. You've got to have a replicating biological entity. And we know today that to have a self-replicating biological machine, that's an incredibly complicated thing.
Self-replicating because you've got to pass on to your kids some of your own genetic characteristics. That's essential to the natural selection process.
Yeah, you've got to be able to have offspring. You've got to be able to have kids. And you've got to have some sort of way of getting the information that describes what you are into them. so that they are like you. And then there's got to be the potential for slight variations in that information so that they can then change over time. And, you know, if someone said to you, you have got to make a robot that is able to self-replicate, it's able to make a copy of itself, you know, just imagine how complex that robot would have to be. Yes. To be able to take raw materials in from outside and then turn all of those raw materials into another robot like itself. You know, I've never heard of anyone actually doing that in engineering today. But that's what you need before evolution, in the Darwinian sense, can even start happening.
Huh. So you're saying actually, in a way, that is it evolution or not, it's a bit of red herring, because even before you get to that point, you've still got massively unsolved problems for the atheists.
Absolutely, yeah. And no one can explain that. So the famous atheist Richard Dawkins, he would say, well, it's a massive stroke of luck that Darwin can't explain it. The Darwinian mechanism can't happen until you've got this. And so it is just simply luck. It's chance. It's very much like saying, you know, this laid table came here purely by chance. You know, bits of metal and wax and leaf were being thrown around and it all just happened to come together like that. You know, just for something as simple as that table, all of us would find that implausible. But he's saying for something as complicated as a self-replicating biological entity, that came about purely by chance. I mean, it beggars belief.
And we're not talking about a table, we're talking about sort of like a computer program, right? So the DNA that builds a cell is like a program. It's just got four letters in the alphabet, but the sequence of those letters. And so even the simplest thing requires a very, very long text, basically. It's like a...
Yeah, software.
Software.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's got to have software, and then it's got to have the machinery to replicate that software and to have something that can take in raw materials, process energy. You know, so it's a combination of software and nanotechnology. But software more complex than we make, and nanotechnology that is way more complex than any nanotechnology that can be made in a lab today.
Hmm. Now, one of the things that really interests me, I did biology at university, not to the same level as he's gone on to do, but one of the things that fascinates me is Darwin's theory is quite old now, it's well over 100 years old, and obviously genetics has advanced enormously, even just in the last, I mean, it's sort of accelerating in the last 10 years, last 20 years. I remember the first sequencing of the human DNA took an international team of scientists years working together. Now you can sequence someone's DNA in an hour or something with a computer. You know, it's very quick. Now, one thing that interests me is as science has understood more, some people think, well, look, there's things we don't understand and people believe in God to fill in the gap they don't understand. But surely as science advances, the gap is going to get smaller. So the bits where you need to go, it's a miracle, God did it, become smaller. The bits that science can explain get bigger. Now, one of the things I'm interested in, as, and we talked about this before, as genetics has advanced, has it made the atheist theory easier to believe or harder to believe? So the recent advances in genetics and evolutionary theory.
I think it's made it harder and harder to believe. I think our understanding of biological complexity over time is just going like that. Our ability to explain it by an evolutionary mechanism is flatlined, or even going slightly down. Mm-hmm. And so the gaps, if you like, are getting bigger. So, for example, in Darwin's time, in the 1850s, a lot of people thought life could just spontaneously originate on a loaf of bread. You know, if you left your loaf of bread for a couple of weeks, it would start to go moldy. That's because life had just spontaneously started on your loaf of bread. And so the origin of life seemed quite a simple thing to people at that stage. They had no idea of the kind of machinery and software that you need for life to happen. And similarly, you know, nobody knew about all of the machinery in our cells. You know, we have something called ATP synthase, which is a tiny, tiny motor that spins around, driven by a flow of hydrogen ions across a membrane. And as it spins extremely fast, it changes the conformation of something above it, and that changes something called ADP into something called ATP. And that's how energy moves around. So at the moment, trillions of these motors are running in my body and your body, enabling us to sit here and talk about these things. Nobody had any idea that that existed till about 30 years ago. Darwin didn't have a clue. And he said, if there are any complex organs which couldn't have come about by a natural process where it can come about through small steps, with each step being functional, then my theory breaks down.
Can I just slow down? Some people know about this already, but if you don't know about this, the idea is the Darwinist mechanism is tiny, tiny changes, each one of which gives you some sort of advantage. So maybe, I have five children, two of them have long noses, three of them have short noses, but it turns out that there's some very dangerous, toxic stuff that you can only detect with a long nose. So my long-nosed children survive because they detect the toxic smell, and my short-nosed children die, whatever. And then they have some children, some have longer noses. And gradually, through these infinitesimally small changes, human beings end up having really long noses. That's basically the sort of story. But it relies on a tiny change that has a tiny advantage. And you're saying this absolutely breaks down at the molecular level. It doesn't work for some of these molecular machines.
Yeah, so every step has to be small enough that it could happen purely by chance. And it also has to be advantageous enough to make it better than what was before. But if you look at some of these structures, no one has even imagined a pathway by which they could have come about just by small changes, step by step. Because when you look at their mechanisms, you can see that when everything is in place, it works. But as soon as you remove parts, of course, this motor will just stop working. It needs all those pieces in place for it to do something useful. You know, you might imagine one or two other machines that you could make from subsets of the machinery that might do something a bit useful. But to come up with a step-by-step process with tiny, tiny steps to gradually build up a molecular motor is something that no one has been able to do. So our knowledge of biological complexity is just growing bigger and bigger all the time. Our ability to explain that by a Darwinian mechanism is not keeping up with that at all.
And are you saying, if other, obviously you're not the only biologist who realise this problem, are you finding that scientists are sort of looking and more open to there being a creator or a designer, or are they still sort of say, your atheist colleagues still just as trenchantly atheist as they were before?
I think some people are looking around for other explanations. Some people are, like me, are saying, okay, it must have been created. It must have been designed by a supernatural creator who was powerful enough to make it. Other people are saying, well, maybe there are other mechanisms that we haven't yet discovered, and they're looking around something called the extended evolutionary synthesis that is trying to get beyond Darwin's mechanism. But generally, the other mechanisms require a lot of complexity to be in place beforehand. It's like sort of trying to design a machine, an evolving machine, if you like. Others are just saying, well, we're going to figure it out one day. We haven't figured it out yet. But I think that as science continues to progress, we're going to discover stuff that explains it without needing to recourse to God.
Yeah. Even though
so there's a range of responses,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, so you're suggesting, so far, just to summarize, you're saying atheism really can't explain why we're here, why there's a universe, why there's a human being with ATP synthase inside us right now, etc. So instead, you as a Christian, me as a Christian, we're believing in a powerful God who is outside of the universe, beyond the universe, and can do miraculous stuff. So just help us with that, because some people may be thinking, atheism isn't doing very well, I get that, but you're willing to believe what God just spoke, let there be light, and the universe appeared. One day there was a man who was dead for 3 days, the first Easter, and then God resurrected him from the dead. I mean, we don't see I suppose the objection is we don't see these kind of things. Miracles don't happen, you know, in front of ordinary people in laboratories. How can you believe Jesus walked on water? How can you believe he healed someone who's blind just using saliva? You know, these crazy one-offs that are totally outside of the experience of what anyone here has ever seen. Isn't that sort of a crazy thing to believe?
No, I don't think it is. I think a creator God is the most rational explanation for what we see around us. To my mind, the complexity that we see in the living world is so great. We are failing so much to have any evolutionary explanation for that to recourse to a creator God is a very rational thing to do. Mm. And I think if we do that, I think it makes sense of a whole load of other aspects of our life as well. Mm. You know, it doesn't just make sense of why there's a universe that can support carbon-based life, why there's a planet in that universe that can support life, why life originated, how conscious entities like us who can talk about these things and think about these things got here. It makes sense of all of that. But it also makes sense of, you know, inside of me I have a deep sense of right and wrong, I have a deep sense of justice, an appreciation for beauty, for love. It makes sense of all of that as well. Mm. So I think on multiple levels it makes sense of the universe and what it means to be a human being and my experience of life. Mm. And I think it's all of those things working together that push me in that direction. Now, if I was seeing miracles happen every day, they would no longer really be miracles. So no one understands how gravity works, really. We can write laws about it and say, you know, I can do a calculation that tells you how fast something will drop and how it's affected by the mass of the planet. But we don't actually know how it works. But none of us call that a miracle because it happens all the time, even though we can't explain it. And if there was a regularity that under certain atmospheric conditions it was always possible to walk on water, then it wouldn't be a miracle that Jesus walked on water. You know,
of course you can do it if it's cold enough, but it wasn't. I think the sea wasn't frozen when Jesus did it. So
yeah.
That's the,
yeah. Yeah. Or you know, if we all knew that under certain conditions a dead body would rise after 3 days, and you know, there was a scientific law that meant that, I don't know, if there was an eclipse of the sun, people rose from the dead, you know, it would stop being a miracle because it would become a regularity, and science is the study of regularities. We could start to predict when it would happen. So it wouldn't be a miracle. So miracles, by definition, are not meant to be happening all the time. They can't, because if they are, they're not miracles. And I think that, so I think there's two lines of evidence for miracles. One is just the existence of the natural world in all its complexity. The other is the historical accounts of Jesus. I find it implausible that people at the time would have been convinced that those miracles happened if they didn't happen. I struggle to understand how it could have been a sort of deceit, because Christianity took off very rapidly in the first century in the Roman Empire. We know that from the Bible and from sources outside the Bible. And at that stage, people could have asked eyewitnesses, well, what happened in Jerusalem at this time? What happened in Cana of Galilee? And if it was all made up, people would have found that out pretty quickly and wouldn't have sacrificed their lives for the sake of Christianity. So I think there's good historical evidence.
And it's interesting, particularly, one of the things I agree with that, and one of the things that persuades me is that the same people who are sacrificing their lives for it are the people who are claiming to be the eyewitnesses of it. So it's not like it's gone through this whole chain of rumours. It's the eyewitnesses themselves are then beaten up, flogged, threatened, killed, but they're still holding to their story because, yeah, as you say, it makes sense if they're sure it really happened. Like, to give your life for somebody that you know can resurrect you from the dead because he resurrected from the dead, it's kind of logical, right? You go, well, I don't really want to be killed for this, but if I am killed, he can get me through this. That's entirely rational. But to be killed for someone that you know lied to you and actually is a fake, why would you do that? So, yeah, I think that's compelling.
And sometimes in science we think about, our prior belief and our posterior belief. So when you come to a bit of evidence, you already have an idea in your mind of how probable something is. And then you look at that evidence. Then after you've looked at it, you then decide after the event whether you believe it. So, for example, if there's a clip-clop of hooves going down the road, and my four-year-old goes to the window and he says to me, "Daddy, there's a horse riding down the road," I wouldn't get out of my armchair and say, "Oh, that's nice, you wave to the horse."
Because he lives in the country, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
if my son came and said, "There's a zebra walking down the road," my prior belief that a zebra might walk down our road is pretty low. And so I would want to come to the window and just check if there was a zebra or not. And then if I saw something out there with stripes and looked like a horse, I'd say, okay, it's a zebra. My posterior belief would be, yes, I believe it. But I would have to check because my prior belief is so low. If that happened and my son said, "There's a unicorn walking down the road," I would say, can't be a unicorn. I would want to not just go to the window and look. I would want to go out there, take a photo, have a good pull at the horn. You know, I would need a lot of convincing it was a unicorn because my prior expectation of there being a unicorn is just so incredibly low. And I think it's like that with the life of Jesus. Because of what I see in the natural world, I think this world is more than just matter and energy and the laws of nature. And so I think miracles have had to have happened to get us the universe, to get us life, and various other steps as well. And so my prior belief that a miracle could happen is a lot greater than that of my atheist friends. And so when I look at the evidence from the life of Jesus, together with what I see in the natural world, I find that the two together convince me, yes, this really did happen.
It's really helpful. What I want to do now, we've got a few minutes left. I want to kind of think, right, so you believe there's a God, he's the creator, he's incredibly powerful, he's the reason we're here. I want to kind of ask the so what question, like what difference does that make to actual life? And I'm going to ask in two different ways. The first one I want to ask about the environment and the planet. So lots of people are worried about global warming and ecological catastrophe. And I know you're an expert in that because you're not only a geneticist, but you're a geneticist of trees. And particularly, you're looking at some species of trees that are all going to die because of us, you know, or some are going to die. And you get asked to speak about this stuff. So the ecology world is an area you move in. And I'm interested to know, as a Christian, how do you feel about the future? So a lot of people in our society, especially a lot of young people, are really, really worried about this. Are we headed for, what do they call it, an environmental apocalypse? As a Christian, how does it shape your optimism or pessimism about the future of the planet? Let's talk about that first.
Well, I think the first thing I'd say that, as a Christian, I care about the planet. Because I believe God created it, I care about it. He obviously cares about it. He has made it, and he's told us that we are, our job is to look after it. You know, we're to look after the garden, we're to care for creation. And so, as a Christian, I think, you know, that is part of our job as human beings. So there's Christian motivation to care for the natural environment. We haven't been given a mandate just to trash it and to live lives of luxury and self-indulgence and waste. That's not what God has put us here for. The other thing I'd also say is that because many people don't have that motivation, because many people think death is going to be the end, and so the next 50 or 60 years of the planet is all that I really care about. From an atheist perspective, I think it's actually quite hard to motivate people to look after the planet. You know, if this life is my only one, then I'm going to want to enjoy it as much as I can. And if that means holidays every year in the Bahamas, well, so be it. You know, why should I really care about making a very slight difference to climate change that is going to affect people that are not related to me and a living after I've died. Maybe I'll want a bit of greenwashing because it's trendy to be green and people will think me a better person if I'm green and trees are planted for my flights or something like that. But actually, at root, it's very hard, I think, to motivate people in a godless world to actually live in a responsible way. And what I see happening is people then resort to kind of scaremongering. And so I see claims that are being made in the name of science, which are actually going quite a long way beyond the evidence and just trying to make people scared in order to try to motivate them to do what they should be doing anyway. And so as a Christian, I feel quite awkward about that because I want people to look after the natural environment. But on the other hand, I don't want science to be used in a way which is simply scaring people and particularly giving despair to teenagers and young people. So I'm more optimistic about the planet than Greta Thunberg is probably. And I'm also very against scaremongering.
In terms of if you go super far, what's your super long-term prediction for the planet as a Christian?
Well, my super long-term prediction is that Jesus will return. Every wrong will be put right. The planet will be renewed and we'll have a new heavens and a new earth. And that is massively different. So if you go on BBC iPlayer and watch Universe with Brian Cox, he says, eventually, the sun is going to go out. The universe will return to the darkness which it had before. And we will be completely forgotten. We were just a flash of light in an infinitely dark universe. And I find that so depressing. And so, you know, why even bother? You know, it's so demotivating to do anything, let alone save the planet. But that's all you have if you're an atheist. Whereas a Christian, you know, I have a definite hope that things, eventually, everything is going to be put right. That doesn't mean I don't try and do the right thing now, not at all, but it does give that overall optimism that life is not pointless. You know, what I do is not going to be forgotten by the universe. The universe is not all there is. There is a God who is watching, who cares, and who ultimately is going to judge all of us for what we've done.
I want to talk more about that as we close. Well, finish interviewing you about what difference it makes very personally. So you talked about your life as a scientist, you talked about your life as an ecologist and the planet, but your life as a husband and father, and I knew about a scary story about your first child, and you told me just a minute ago there was another scary story about your most recent child. So tell us, in the face of suffering and fear for life and death, what difference it's made to you to be a Christian?
Well, it's made a huge difference. So, as you say, Andrew, when our first child was born, he had a stroke around the time of his birth and was in intensive care for several days. And to start with, we didn't know why he was having seizures. And a stroke was actually one of the better prognoses that it could have been at the time. And that was a really, really difficult time for me and my wife. Obviously, we prayed for him a lot, and thankfully today, you know, he's fine. He's at a normal school. You wouldn't know he'd had a stroke. And we know other children who've gone through a similar thing, where they still have very serious issues from it. Mm. And then with our fourth child, who was born just over 6 months ago in a planned home birth, everything went fine. At the very last minute, his shoulder got stuck. And so he was just, his head was in the world, and the clock was ticking very, very fast because his umbilical cord was also trapped. And this went on for a very long time, and the two midwives were just trying everything to get this baby out. And by this time, I was just praying out loud that you know, he would survive. And thankfully, eventually, he came out. And to start with, wasn't breathing. They tried resuscitation. He wasn't breathing. And my wife and I was just kneeling by my wife, and we were just praying that he would live. And then thankfully, we heard him cry. And it was such an answer to prayer. And afterwards, I said to the midwife, she came back a couple of weeks later, and I said, you know, how close do you think he came to dying? And her answer was very interesting, because she said, I don't think he was very close to dying because he revived. And I thought, okay, so it's not because it was a short shoulder dystocia. It wasn't. It was a very long one. They were clearly incredibly worried while it was happening. And so I just think it was such an answer to prayer that he did live. Mm. And my interpretation of the fact that he revived is not that he wasn't, you know, safe the whole time, but that God answered our prayers. And so we're so thankful about that. And it's in situations like that that just humble you so much. You realize how powerless you are. And also you realize that life is just the most valuable thing. You know, we think so much about our houses and our money and reputation, and academia is all about reputation in many ways. But at the end of the day, life is so valuable. And the difference between being alive and being dead is just so huge. Mm-hmm. And for that baby to be a living baby, just the most important thing. And that's what God offers us in Jesus, you know, life. And it brings me back to what Jesus says about offering us eternal life. You know, if physical life in this world is such a valuable thing, the most valuable thing we can have, to have eternal life and for that life to be able to go on forever and ever, for him to have conquered death, that is just so important. That is more important than anything else. And yeah, I want that life, and I want everyone else to have that life too.
Thank you so much, Richard, for coming, and it's been fascinating, I think. So let's give him thanks for the traditional way.
Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to sing now about God as the creator. We've been hearing about that from Professor Buggs, and we're going to join in praise of God for that. If you'd like to join in, please do. Please stand. Mm.